Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order. First order of business, although a quorum is present, is approval of the minutes. Vice Chair Agbaje, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Reviewed and so moved.
The minutes are moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Members, we have three bills up today, and the first bill is House File. It's Manufactured Housing Day in the Housing Committee. Up first, we have House File 817, Representative Feist. Representative Feist, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And first order of business, I will move that House File 817 be re-referred to the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Feist, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Manufactured home parks provide a vital, affordable housing option compared to traditional stick-built homes and apartment units. Over 180,000 individuals live in about 900 licensed parks, 80% of whom are low or very low income. These communities represent around 50,000 households in nearly all 87 counties. This bill is simple. It would require community owners to notify residents of an opportunity to purchase their manufactured housing communities. This requirement of a 60-day notice period replaces the current general requirement that is already intended to serve this purpose, but only applies if a park is officially listing for sale with a real estate broker or through public advertising. This kind of formal listing rarely happens, so this bill simply closes an existing loophole in the law and explicitly creates the 60-day notice period. Here's what this bill does not do. It does not prevent an owner from seeking other offers. It does not prevent the owner from selling multiple communities simultaneously. And it does not give special weight to the offer by residents or require acceptance of their offer. This is good policy. Resident-owned manufactured housing communities have proven to make deeper investments in improving their communities, more regularly replacing roads, upgrading water and sewer systems, building storm shelters, and adding playgrounds, while keeping rent increases to as little as $6 a month. This notice requirement has worked smoothly and without conflict in six other states, including New Hampshire, where this has been law for over 30 years. I would like to note that I am heartened by recent conversations amongst stakeholders about partnering this measure with a tax incentive to accept offers by residents. We need to be thoughtful and strategic in how we structure policies to support manufactured housing in Minnesota, as it is an important source of affordable housing in our state. And with that, I will turn it over to the real expert.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And I will note we have seven testifiers up in another bill, so if testifiers could keep their remarks to 3 minutes or less, that would be appreciated. Up first, we have Dave Anderson, Executive Director with APAC.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. As was said, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm with All Park Alliance for Change, which is the statewide association for Minnesota's manufactured homeowners. I want to thank the committee for dedicating time today to manufactured housing and the people who call manufactured housing home. In particular, I was going to talk about House File 817, the resident opportunity to purchase proposal. As Representative Feist pointed out, it's a simple proposal, but it's very important to the residents. It simply requires community owners to provide notice of a potential sale and replaces the current requirement that hasn't been functioning as intended. This proposal, again, does not require community owners to sell to the residents or to lower their price. The community owner still has exclusive rights to determine what properties they sell and to whom they sell them. However, residents without receiving notice are seeing communities in Minnesota rapidly being, gobbled up by out-of-state buyers. In the past 5 years, 18% of manufactured home park lots have changed hands, and 55% of those sales have been to out-of-state buyers. A year ago, it was 70% of sales going to out-of-state buyers. And who owns these communities does have a significant impact. What we've seen in the Twin Cities metro area is that 10 of the 10 parks with the highest lot rents are those purchased by out-of-state buyers. On the other hand, as is illustrated in one of the editorials that was provided as background information, The residents have greatly improved the communities that they own, often with no rent increase or a minimal rent increase. As Representative Feist pointed out, this has worked well in other states. It's a proposal that's been endorsed by the Homes for All Coalition, which has 270 organizational members, and we urge the committee to support House File 817. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Up next, we have Natividad Seafeld, president of Park Plaza Cooperative. Ms. Seafeld, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Representative Howard and members of the Housing and Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Natividad Seafeld. I own a home in Park Plaza Cooperative, a manufactured home community in the city of Fridley, and I serve as the president of the board. Our cooperative is home to 81 families at this time. I am fortunate to live in one of Minnesota's 10 resident-owned communities. Park Plaza Cooperative became a resident-owned community on February 15, 2011, and that starts our wonderful story. Before 2011, I had to live with the same uncertainty as 45,000 Minnesota families face every day. In this day, I received a notice, is this the day I receive a notice that I have to move because the community is being closed? Is this the day my family finds out we are forced to leave our home, job, friends, and family? Or will it be like many other days, a day where many neighbors and I keep asking for repairs and improvements that never happen, a day where community rules are unfairly applied, a day when rent gets raised on a whim? But for me, today, everything is different. I do not fear losing my home. My neighbors and I make improvements to our homes, knowing that it's an investment we won't lose due to decisions of someone else's that someone else makes. We also welcome new people into our community, and they are relieved to move into our community where they can feel safe and secure. My household budget also feels more manageable. I know that the land rent will only go up if the cost of managing the community increases beyond what the community has already planned for. We are proud of the fact that we manage our community well, and we have had no significant rent increases in the past 13 years. The last one was $5 just this year. It is also important that you know we improve our community. We have done $1 million of infrastructure. This included new water systems, sewer lining, new streets, added fire hydrants, which we didn't have, added more street lights, and added more manholes to have better access to our sewer systems. We have even added readable water meters and new water lines to every home. All of this was done without raising the rent. We have also added a new storm shelter and community center, only raising the rent $6 with a full vote of the members. Buying the community wasn't easy. It was long, hard, and nerve-wracking process for the residents, but we did it. It would have been easier with the type of policies proposed today in House File 817. In closing, I and I know other residents of Park Plaza sleep better at night knowing our community is ours. It truly makes all of us together, land and homeowners. I am asking the Minnesota legislature to make it easier for all other residents to preserve our community as well, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Up next, we have Mark Bruner with the Modular and Manufactured Home Association. Mr. Bruner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of handouts for the committee, if I could provide those.
Yes. Could we have a page help hand those out? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before this committee for the first time this session. The Manufactured Modular Home Association is sort of the umbrella organization for the industry in Minnesota, representing residential builders of modular homes and manufactured homes. There are about 1,000 privately owned manufactured home communities in Minnesota that we also represent, as well as lenders and manufactured home installers and others. We're founded in 1951 and going on over 70 years in existence, representing the industry. And there are about 15 plants in the state building building modular homes. Four of those also build manufactured homes. Nationally, there are, I think, 140 plants that build manufactured homes. Minnesota is home to four of those, so we spend a lot of our time trying to make sure that we retain those plants in Minnesota. We're the largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing in the state. So I'll briefly explain our concerns. I know we have some other testifiers here who are members to express their comments regarding the bill. Minnesota is currently recognized as one of the top states in the nation in providing residents of manufactured home communities with an equal opportunity and protection to purchase their community when it's offered for sale or sold for redevelopment. And Minnesota exceeds states like Florida, Arizona, California, all of which have many more residents in manufactured home communities than the state of Minnesota. One of the things Minnesota does require right now, if a manufactured home community is going to be sold, is something called a notice of sale. It's found in Minnesota Chapter 327C. And it lets the residents know, if they're offering their community for sale, that they're doing that, giving residents actually an opportunity. At the same time, something is posted with a real estate brokerage or an ad somewhere, that they have an opportunity to purchase it. They can put together an offer and come to the community owner. So it shouldn't be a surprise in that regard when one is available. We've also worked, my members have sold their communities to cooperatives. We were some of the first in the nation. One of the letters, or a letter that's being circulated for one of my members, explains how he did this. Was the first in the state to sell a community, I believe it was the Fridley Plaza Cooperative, to the residents. Then sold two others. To his residents, and in all cases, he worked with the residents. There's no need for a right of first refusal or first opportunity to purchase. And he points out in his letter that this would actually be detrimental to the residents, because what it would simply do is allow a bigger investor type to make a large, a significant offer to purchase a community, and essentially price out a cooperative opportunity, because when they go to finance a manufactured home community for conversion, they have to meet minimum appraisal requirements, where somebody coming in from the outside can essentially offer what they want to, and then the property stays in private hands, and you have the ability then that they can simply raise the rents to recoup those costs. So there are unintended consequences here constitutionally, in terms of the owner of a manufactured home community losing the ability, something's called an option to purchase, where you might have someone who would approach an owner and say, we would like the first option or opportunity to purchase if you're ever going to sell. The bill takes that away. That's a significant, valuable property right that's lost in the legislation. It requires notice be given, and I think we're the only, this would be the only property class in the state of Minnesota that's required to notify a state agency that you're selling your property. At the same time, you're required to notify the residents of the manufactured home community that you've received an offer, you're considering selling your property, that then things get put on hold for 60 days while they try to come up with the financing to purchase it. In the meantime, you've had to notify, let's say you've got a community with only 100 home sites, You have to notify every resident. That could be 300 individual certified letters that need to be sent to each of the residents. If somebody doesn't receive it, misplaces it, it gets lost in the mail service, that would be grounds for a challenge legally. So you've got your 60 days, you've got to wait, and then, if they don't get the offer, someone can say, well, gee, I didn't get the notice. So, by that time, a prospective buyer walks, and they say, we're just not able to, continue this process in Minnesota. And I guess the reality is that, gee, I don't want to end up in these same shoes if I end up, trying to sell. So, then you lose the sale. What happens then? The owner, can't sell. The residents weren't able to buy it. So you again have a significant loss of value and a taking of property. One of the things that we do like, Mr. Chairman, is what you're trying to do in a bill that's going to be heard later today, House File 814. To provide an incentive, economic incentive, for a cooperative to purchase with the, I think it's a new program being established with $15, $25 million in assistance that would help them acquire a community. I think that that's a much better approach. I mean, there are nearly a thousand privately owned communities in the state. Most of them are in greater Minnesota. And if they, if they would go out and simply offer to make a purchase, as what happened with the letter, the example that passed out to the committee, there might be some success. If we set up an adversarial relationship right away, that every time if you get an offer to purchase your property, you now suddenly have to put the brakes on, notify residents, you could go to litigation. There's going to be an adversary relationship, and perhaps deals that could otherwise happen won't, just because of the nature of somebody tries to purchase their property. And I know there are other testifiers that will get into some of the details of this more than I have. But,
thank you, Mr. Bruner.
And hope to work with the author in cleaning some of this up, and maybe can have a. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Up next, we have Michelle Carlson. Ms. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Howard and committee members. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak about House File 817. My name is Michelle Carlson. I'm a second-generation community owner and licensed real estate broker here in the state of Minnesota. I live in Grand Rapids, and I had a chance to come down today in which to speak in regards to this very important and gravely important bill. I've worked for 25 years in real estate, and I do specialize in manufactured housing property management. I'm an active voice with affordable housing. I sit on the MMHA board, the Habitat for Humanity board in my Itasca County area, and also the local chamber. And I oversee 1,200 home sites in the state of Minnesota with 6 manufactured home communities, both in the metro area as well in greater Minnesota. I was raised in a manufactured home in a community setting just north of St. Cloud, and my first purchase of a home was a manufactured home. I certainly believe it is my mission as a community owner to make sure that I provide that same sense of neighborhood to my residents when they live in our communities. One of our largest communities is up in Duluth, Minnesota, 500 home site community. And we've owned that since 1981, 42 years in our asset portfolio. And I'm honored to be doing the property management there. We've increased that community with 200 home sites. We've upgraded infrastructure of both electric, gas, water, and sewer. We've increased and updated our playgrounds, off-street parking, et cetera. It's a beautiful community, and I'm very proud to offer this to my residents. And we also have, of course, professional management teams that I work with to ensure that our residents have a wonderful area for social gatherings, that they see a beautiful community. A neighborhood that people are very proud to call home. residents have been with me 10 or 20 years. They are raising, they've raised their families, and now their children are coming to us, choosing to purchase homes. These are homeowners with choice, and they are choosing to live in manufactured housing in a land lease community that I can offer. Certainly, I have major concerns about this bill, and it has to do with maintaining the ability to sell my community in the future, the community that I have developed for the last 25 years, and it's my livelihood. The first one certainly is that the bill takes away a fundamental real estate property right of a manufactured home community owner to grant that first right of option to purchase to prospective buyers. This is going to be a significant loss of income without just compensation. Second, the bill takes away the property right to package more than just one property together. It may also take away my ability to sell a manufactured home sales center or installation business that I have or mini storage business that I have. And certainly it would diminish my property values, could delay a sale by 6 months or more, even deter a home buyer or a community buyer. I mean, why would somebody wait around for 6 months or more and then probably have to go to court on this situation? It's an unfair taking of property rights. We have other cooperative grocery stores in our area, but neither of them have the first right of opportunity to purchase required if they go on the sales market. Senior apartments similarly don't have a right to purchase a privately owned apartment building for sale. So why are private manufactured home communities being singled out? Resident ownership of communities is always happening in Minnesota organically. Please continue to let that happen. Let the market work. I hope to continue to offer good, clean, affordable communities for years to come. And we're moving forward with plans to develop one up in Greater Minnesota in the Grand Rapids area. And we've acquired the land, and we're in the process of preparing to build new. But if the law that you, the bill that you are looking to become law continues, my focus on growing this kind of a business would diminish. Affordable, non-subsidized housing is greatly needed in Minnesota, and I'm happy to provide a community setting for that. And private manufactured community owners are some of the biggest advocates for affordable housing. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to share my concerns about House File 817 and why it should not become law. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Dustin Breakmeyer.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Chairman Howard and committee members. My name is Dustin Brockmeyer. My Brockmeyer property is owned by me and my four siblings. In 1975, my father purchased the park in Chaska, Minnesota. It has 250 homes in it. We've ran that park for the last 48 years. We're very proud of our ownership of mobile home parks. We're very proud of the people that live in our parks. We have very good relations with the community. We build community events focusing around helping the community get better. In our Chaska Park, for example, we have a tutoring program. Kids come and get tutored. The school district provides a tutor. We provide a building. We provide a high-speed internet. We provide everything that they would need to do a successful tutoring program. We also provide backpacks for all kids that need it in any of our communities. We, at the beginning of school year, if you need a backpack, we have one for you. You don't need to go get one. On Christmas time, we provide Christmas presents to every child in all of our communities with no exceptions. Brockmeyer Properties owns 8 manufactured home communities in Minnesota. We own 2 in Wisconsin, one in South Dakota. We are a local owner. We live here. I live in Waconia, Minnesota. My family all lives in Carver County. We're very close to our area. Today I'm here for the very first time. I've never testified before. This is my very first testimony. to express the concerns with House Bill 817. Speaking as someone who's planned and to continue providing workforce housing, developing manufactured home communities in Minnesota, as well as adding new home sites, we want to continue that. That is very important to us. I am a licensed residential contractor, a licensed manufactured home installer. I hold a mechanical bond. I serve on the Manufactured Home Association. I also serve on Christmas and May Board. I serve on a lot of different things to help our community. We build communities wherever we're at. That's our thing. That's what we do. I have a few concerns and reasons that I want to pause to make you make some thoughts. What if I decide to sell two of my communities as a package to a prospective buyer? Am I allowed to do that? I don't know what one means.
No.
Oh. What if I proactively offer to sell one of my communities to my residents? Do I have to follow everything in the bill? Under the bill, a resident is anyone living in a manufactured home. With 100 homes, I could have these 300 police. I just need that to be cleared up on who would be the one to get the notices. The bill takes the fundamental away of real estate rights of the manufactured homeowner to grant a right the first option to purchase to a prospective buyer, resulting in significant loss of income and compensation if it's a taking. We do not plan on selling our park, but someday we may. I want to have the option to be able to sell it to who I bet that would be the best for that property. It may be the community owners. It may be someone from out of state. I don't know. Today we're not selling. The bill will take away another right, my ability to package more one part of my business together to receive an offer. I wouldn't be able to sell, if I have a small apartment building, I wouldn't be able to sell that. I wouldn't be able to divide those properties up. I would have to sell them as a whole. That would make it less profitable for me. Finally, I continually receive offers to purchase my community portfolio from all types of potential buyers from all over the country. But not once have my residents or co-op group approached me with an offer. Selling has not been my choice. We are in here for long run, long term. We're second generation. At least under the existing laws governing the ability to sell a community. We also own a community in western Minnesota, or western Wisconsin, and another one in South Dakota. Neither state has the right, first right to purchase law. So there would be options for us to change our business model from growing in Minnesota to doing that what is best and develop workforce housing in other states. Essentially, this bill enacted would be a huge invitation for large investor groups to move in Minnesota, making offers to owners such as myself that residents could never match. I thank you for your time. I appreciate everything. And whatever you decide, please, please remember, you're affecting my life. You're affecting my children's lives. Just put some thought into it before you decide. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Mark Lambert. Mr. Lambert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Howard and committee members. I really appreciate the opportunity to address you today. My name is Mark Lambert. Like Michelle, like Dustin, like others here, we have a lot of history in these communities. Quick background for me, growing up, I learned to manufacture homes when my family purchased and lived in a small one in a community park in Red Wing many, many years ago. We found it was just terrific housing. When I was 16, my dad co-signed a loan for me, and I bought my first mobile home and rented it out as an investment. By the time I was 18, I had 13 mobile homes, a pickup truck, my own checkbook, and I was renting out mobile homes to people in the St. Cloud area. I bought my first community when I was 21 in 1984. I still own that community today. I'm going to be 60 the end of this month, and we have been a family-owned, family-operated community for 38 years now. Been to this committee a few times and had the opportunity to address legislative sessions over the years. So I'm happy to be here and happy to be able to share some thoughts with you. As you might guess, I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 817. The bill has significant issues, and I would ask that you not move it forward without proper vetting. The first issue, and frankly, I think it's a game stopper, and you've heard comments about this, is that this very type of opportunity to purchase, as it's called, and I guess I would probably paraphrase it to say first right of refusal, is and has been found to be unconstitutional. Without getting too far into what might sound like a constitutional law lesson, the proposed bill is an unconstitutional infringement on the community owner's real estate property rights. As I'm sure many of you heard, the property rights that owners possess are often referred to as the bundle of rights or bundles of sticks. The bundles of sticks have five elements, just for a little lesson. Right of possession, the right to obviously have it, the right to control it, the right to exclude people, the right to enjoy it, and lastly, the right to dispose of it, including the right to transfer other people. The power to grant the first right of refusal has repeatedly been recognized by courts across the country as a bundle of sticks which enjoys a vested property right. We're talking about one of those sticks today at this hearing. If passed into 817, or if passed into law, House File 817 will result in an unconstitutional regulatory taking. The courts routinely have held that regulatory taking occurs when a regulation or law deprives the property owner of the fundamental attributes of property ownership. Any one of the sticks of bundles is taken. In this case, the right to sell the community to whoever the community owners choose. It's important to note that in 1990, and I think this is significant, the state of Washington adopted a very, very similar first right of refusal to House File 17. When subsequently challenged by the state community owners, the Washington State Supreme Court, as you might guess, struck down the legislation as being unconstitutional regulatory taking. They said a first right of refusal in the hands of the park owners is fundamental attribute of ownership and a valuable property right, and that forced to transfer this right under statute constitutes a taking. That's what we're talking about here, a forced transfer of rights. Here in the state, both the Minnesota Constitution and the First Amendment restrict the taking of private property for public use without just compensation. The piece that's missing here is that this is not a public use. This is a specific statute that would require one private property party to specifically transfer it to another private property. There is no public purpose here. The legislative transfer in House File 817 is a direct transfer from the community residents who are private to the residents who are also private. The bill, if passed, will take the private property rights from one individual and transfer it to another private individual. Clearly, the courts have established this to be an unconstitutional overreach. House File 817, in my opinion, is an unconstitutional overreach and should not be passed. Thank you very much for the opportunity to voice my concerns, and I continue to look forward to working with the committee and the legislature for many, many years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last, we have Matthew Spellman with the Minnesota Realtors.
Well, I feel like everybody, the previous testifier, stole my material. So I'm going to try and avoid being duplicative here. My name is Matt Spellman. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. For those of you who are not familiar with our association, we are a business trade association that represents over 22,000 real estate professionals that are working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. I first want to thank Representative Feist for taking time yesterday to meet with me. I know everybody has a busy schedule. I know that I'm getting my steps in these days, which is great for my waistline. You know, I want to just cover a couple of points that previous testifiers have covered. First, Minnesota Realtors supports policies that recognize and protect the rights to own, use, and transfer real property. One of the fundamental rights of any property owner is the ability to freely market and sell their property without unreasonable restrictions. and an owner of any property, including a manufactured home park, may have numerous business and or personal reasons to decide to sell their property. By creating this opportunity to purchase process in House File 817, it would substantially interfere with this important property right. The second concern that Minnesota Realtors has is that this adversely affects the timeliness of a transaction. So we generally oppose anything that will interfere with the timeliness of a transaction. And based on our read of the bill, that this, you know, this could stall the transaction for up to 75 days. Meanwhile, there may be a potential buyer with the resources to purchase and invest in the property, but who are not willing or able to wait out the delay that this bill mandates. Again, I want to thank Representative Feist for her time, as well as she referenced potentially working on an incentive-based approach, and that is something that we would really appreciate continuing the dialogue on. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Representative Feist, I wonder if you just had any few comments, and then we do have an amendment, but any comments to kick us off here?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to remind folks what this bill does not do. It does not prevent an owner from seeking other offers. It does not prevent the owner from selling multiple communities simultaneously, and it does not give special weight to the offer by residents or require acceptance of the offer. I have a number of other kind of high-level thoughts that I can say for my concluding comments, but I just wanted to remind people that of what this bill does not do.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And I know that there's an A1 amendment. I believe Representative Nash, are you going to be offering the A1 amendment?
I will not.
Okay. Then let's move to discussion. Up first, Representative Nash.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Breckmeyer, for being here. You live in my city, and I'm your representative, and I've got your back here. I think this is just another one of the fundamental conversations that we have been having here lately as to what is the disposition of property rights. I am an ardent supporter of property rights, so that if I or Representative Cha, as you had talked about when you were a real estate agent, you have the right to sell the things that you own. And that is a fundamental right that we have preserved for us. And, you know, Representative Feist, you're my friend, and I appreciate our relationship, but I can't disagree with this bill anymore. First and foremost, that what we've heard from the testifiers is that this adversely impacts their ability to do with their property that which they'd like to do. And, you know, you've got all those testifiers over there that this is multi-generational, long-time family investments that people have put their shoulder to the mill for a long, long time. And this is telling them we're changing the dynamic of your ability to dispose of your property or transfer it to somebody else within the family. You might want to sell it or whatever. This basically makes it so that they can't do that without the heavy hand of government first coming in and say, well, there's another layer that we're going to place upon this, so it really does erode your ability to do things in the manner in which you choose. And I find it particularly curious. I've got here the decision of the Washington Supreme Court in the Manufactured Housing Communities v. Washington, and their conclusion in the majority opinion was, we have found the statutory grant of right of first refusal to tenants of a mobile home park amounts to a taking of transfer private property without the judicial determination of public necessity and without just compensation having been first paid as required as amended Article 116. Moreover, the transfer is legislatively granted to tenants who are private persons, not public. You know, I've been here long enough to know that when we have bills that in other states have been knocked down because they are deemed unconstitutional, that that's something that we want to raise our hand and say, we should probably slow this down. And I just don't know that this is the right solution. I find it very troubling that we are now going to insert ourselves as an additional layer into a decision that ultimately gets to be made by the people who own the property is in question. So I don't have to have, as an owner of a home, I don't have to offer the right of first refusal to somebody else. That's I'm not going to quote Representative New Brindley and use that certain word, but that is absurd that we would now do this for this application. I just think that what we're looking at here is, as we did with the bill last week, that we are now adversely impacting people's ability to own, acquire, or dispose of property in the manner in which they see fit. And, you know, in reading our founding documents, in reading things like the Federalist Papers, this is a constant conversation, and I'm sure you've read that document because I know you're smart and we've talked about things like this in the past. This was never something that was brought up in that. That the foundation of our very way of living in our government is predicated on the right to purchase property. And nerd trivia for you, initially it was written life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or the second was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It was first life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. That's how important this is. And this, I believe, Mr. Breakmeyer and all the others, this gets in the way of them being able to do that which their families have done for a very long time. I again stand in tremendous opposition for this. And Mr. Chair, what is the pathway for this bill?
This bill, the motion is to re-refer this bill to the Commerce Committee.
Okay. Is it being referred to Judiciary at all?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain.
I'm not sure.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank goodness for that. No. It is going to Commerce. I'm not certain if it's going to Judiciary.
If I could ask the author, you'll know the pathway of this.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't believe that it would need to go to Judiciary. My understanding is that it would go to Commerce. We can have a conversation offline about that, but this doesn't feel like it implicates Judiciary. I suppose it has implications for potential lawsuits, so I can consider it. I honestly just knew that my next stop was Commerce.
Yep. And lastly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Obviously, there are going to be some back office dealings if the state is going to have to handle some of the requirements of the enforcement of this. I don't see a fiscal note in our packet. Is this another case of the fiscal note not catching up with the bill? I mean, obviously, you've got enforcement issues, right? The state is not going to get involved in this at all. If they're in abrogation of this offer, certainly there's going to be a penalty phase, and there's something that happened there, the state would have to get involved.
Representative Feist?
Yeah, thank you. So the remedies are a lawsuit. And so that is how, you know, a lot of laws that we create can create a right of action, and that doesn't necessarily mean that there would be a fiscal note.
Representative Nash, a quick follow-up. I do have my other members on the list. But.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that this is, it should have a fiscal note. There are going to be costs associated with the state. I hate to use this word, but it's sloppy to not have one here with us. So. We'll deal with that as we get to how do we move this bill out. So thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had just had a clarifying question of one of the first testifiers that probably isn't impactful to the final decision here, so I will withdraw my question. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And, you know, I'm generally somebody who likes to let the free market work and do its thing. But we also don't have a completely unregulated free market in our country. There are times where we think that there's compelling public policy reasons for us to put certain regulations or restrictions on how that market works and how certain assets are disposed of. And I've talked extensively in this committee already about the fact that I have the most manufactured housing of any house district in the state. And recently, one of my constituents called me. She lives in one of the parks in my district, and she was distressed. She's lived in that park since 1990. And a new owner bought the park just about 2 years ago. It used to be locally owned. Now it's owned by an out-of-state buyer, and her rent, her lot rent, is going to be increasing from $375 a month to $500 a month. That's a 33% increase at one time. So if that's the idea of letting the market work, I have a problem with the market working that way. Because this is a very unique asset class. This is not an apartment building. If I were living in an apartment and my landlord raised the rent by 33%, I'd go rent a U-Haul and I'd be out, you know, maybe $100 for the U-Haul and some hours of my time and, you know, maybe some pizza for my buddies to come help me move. But I'd be able to move and find a place with more affordable rent. You can't do that very easily with a manufactured home. We used to call them mobile homes. Most of these homes, especially if they've been in one place since 1990, are not particularly mobile anymore. And so you're stuck in place. And so these are assets where people have their homes. And I think we need to keep that in mind as we're thinking about this, especially because there are other types of asset classes where we put restrictions on how they're disposed of. I think of certain securities where you can only sell them to accredited investors. Or if you're going to do a public offering, there's all kinds of paperwork and regulations you have to go through and timelines. And so I think when there are certain compelling reasons why we should step in and look, take a hard look at how certain assets are sold, I think there are reasons why we as a legislature need to put guardrails in place and make sure that we're protecting all the citizens of Minnesota and making sure that they can pursue that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that they want to enjoy as well.
Thank you, Representative Norris. I'm going to go to Representative Johnson, and then we're going to go to Representative Feist for some final comments.
Chair Howard, Representative Feist, I got a couple questions for you and a couple comments. First of all, one question, I don't know if you know anything about realty or not, and for sales of property, maybe Representative Gosseth would be able to answer this question if you don't know the answer. But how long is a normal purchase agreement valid before it expires?
Representative Feist?
Sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm so good at that normally. I do not know the answer to that question.
Maybe Dasseth, who's a realtor, could answer that. How long is a purchase agreement usually good before you have to have an answer, whether it's accepted or rejected?
That's a great question, Representative Johnson. I think it really depends on how the contract is written. However, time is always the essence. I think a buyer is always willing to look at making an acquisition quite quickly, so they want to have an answer, because if they don't have that opportunity, they're going to move on to something different. So I'd say you want to have a due diligence time relatively quick, so I think that's a major factor.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Feist. That's the issue in this thing with your bill, because it requires 60 days notification before an offer. The residents that have to be notified 60 days before an offer can be accepted. You do the certified mail, you might be looking at, well, that's, I can give one example. I sent some mail one time from out of state. I was on vacation to my sheriff's office where I worked at the time. That letter arrived 6 months later. So they never got, it took 6 months to get there. Now you're at another 60 days before you get that, do it. Even just doing the certified mail, sending it to the residents in that trailer or mobile home park, whatever you want to, manufactured home park, you're looking at 70 days. Purchase agreements are usually handled within 2 weeks, giving time to do it. You're completely shutting out the possibility of sale of these. And if you can't sell them, the value goes down. Another question I have is why, is there any other area of housing that the Minnesota Housing Financing Agency has to be notified of any sales, Representative Feist?
Representative Feist.
I am not aware of the answer to that question.
I will say I know that there's municipalities that have advance notice of sales for other types of properties, but Reverend Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Feist, I'm just wondering why it makes it interesting why the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency has to be notified if there's going to be a sale. Another issue I have is in this bill, is there a, I'm just wondering if there a reason why your requirement of any sale of a mobile or a, of these manufactured home parks, they can't be changed or used for anything else for 10 years? That's on 3.25 to 3.28 if the manufactured park is sold. Must be preserved as manufactured home park for 10 years from date of sale.
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. I'll provide a quick answer, and then I can turn it over to Mr. Anderson, who is steeped in this, in the way it was drafted. But basically what we're doing is trying to achieve the ultimate goal of this bill, which is to ensure stability in resident-owned manufactured housing communities. And Mr. Anderson may be able to provide even more insight into the thought process behind this drafting.
Mr. Anderson.
Well, and it, Mr. Chair, committee members, it mirrors other requirements such as the right of first refusal that exists for manufactured housing under state law, where if there is an exercise of a right that's intended to help to preserve affordable housing, then the intent is to make sure that that is the actual use. And certainly in a case where the residents would be seeking to buy their community, they wouldn't seemingly be interested in buying it to displace themselves. But it seems to be a consistent policy. It's consistent with the right of first refusal. It's something that in the right of first refusal, which is different, of course, from the opportunity to purchase. And I hope people are keeping that in mind, because it feels like there was a little bit of a progression from this notice requirement seems like a first right of refusal, which in the state of Washington, based on the state of Washington's state constitution, was found to be unconstitutional. So hopefully we'll keep in mind that it's a notice requirement. It's not a right of first, it's not a first right to purchase. And the case that was cited had to do with a different state's constitution. But the language about affordability and ensuring that for a minimum of 10 years it continues to be operated as a manufactured home park is language actually that in discussions in 2019 about updating the right of first refusal that the Community Owners Association itself drafted. So we took the language that had been drafted for the right of first refusal, inserted it into the opportunity to purchase. It seemed like it would be one of the least controversial things to do. To ensure that the right is used for what it's intended to be used for and not some other kind of purpose.
Representative Johnson, any final comment?
Chair Howard, Representative Feist, there are some major issues that need to be dealt with in this bill. Hopefully Commerce can take care of that. Right now, if a developer wanted to purchase that to put in at 15 lot mobile home park or manufactured home park to put in a 200 unit Section 8 housing, they'd have to wait 10 years to do that. You have now devalued the property with this bill. Makes it difficult for any manufactured home park owner want to do any upgrades, because with this bill it devalues the property to the point where he cannot take his retirement out of it if he wants to sell it. He could not sell it to a family member very easily without going through a long process. A lot of times when developers come in that want to buy that, and it could be a pension fund that's buying it. It could be the teacher's pension fund from Minnesota that's buying that. And yes, they do buy them because it's an investment for the dollars of the citizen. But with taking the value out of it, I have a bad inclination that the repairs and the upgrades to those communities is going to be lacking because the overall investment is going away because of some of the things in this bill. And hopefully, like I said, in commerce, they can take care of that.
Representative Feist, a final comment.
Thank you. I have so many things to say, Mr. Chair, but I'll try to be concise. To echo Representative Norris, manufactured housing communities are unique. These are people who own their homes, but they do not own the property beneath them. They don't have control over investments in their plumbing, in creating beautiful community spaces like in the Ciudad community. They don't have that control. And so these are uniquely vulnerable residents. These are uniquely vulnerable homeowners, and there are 180,000 of them, 50,000 families across Minnesota. So this is impacting a lot of people, not just the owners of these communities. Rights do not exist in a vacuum. For example, free speech does not exist in a vacuum. We have reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. The same is true for property rights. Our rights are always in relation to the rights of the people around us, and so we need to take that into account here. Negotiations generally help up the sale value is what I have found. When there is a bidding war on a property, usually that is good for the seller. Wanted to point that out. Section 327C.096 already exists in law saying that notice must be provided. It's just notice is only required to be provided in a formal listing, which is not how these properties are typically sold anymore. And so this is really just addressing a loophole in a law that already exists under state statute. Six other states have already done this. The world did not end. New Hampshire has had this in place for 30 years. Washington is not in our circuit, and this decision was apparently under state court law, so not really applicable here. And lastly, I have many other things to say, but I will just leave it at the impact of this is not just about convenience and sale price. It is the real human lives of the residents of these communities, and I saw in my own district the situation with Lowry Grove and how it displaced an entire community when they did not have notice and they did not have an ability to come together and purchase their property. And so I think we need to keep those real human lives and families and children in mind when we look at important policies like this that will help protect these residents. And so I would urge the committee to vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Feist. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 8. Representative Nash?
I make a motion to table this on lines 2.9 through 2.13 and 4.7 through 4.13. There are instances of the MHFA that does create a fiscal note, and therefore I make a motion to table and request a roll call.
Representative Nash requests a no call. I'd urge members to vote against the motion. Take the roll.
Chair Howard.
No.
Chair Howard, nay. Vice Chair Gbaje.
No.
Vice Chair Gbaje, nay. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Cha.
No.
Representative Cha, nay. Representative Dotseff.
Aye.
Representative Dotseff, aye. Representative Hassan.
Nay.
Nay. Representative Hassan, nay. Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Hussein, nay. Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Kozlowski, nay. Representative Myers.
Aye.
Representative Myers, aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Nash, aye. Representative Norris.
No.
Representative Norris, nay. Representative Perez Vega.
No.
Representative Perez Vega, nay. Representative Petersburg.
Yes.
Representative Petersburg, aye. Chair, that concludes roll call with 5 ayes and 8 nays.
The motion fails. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 817 be referred to the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. You're on your way with that bill. Up next, we have House File 156. You can stay up there, Representative Feist. And I'll move that House File 156 be re-referred to the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this one everyone will like. I would like to thank the Minnesota Manufacturing.
Oh. Representative Feist, first, I understand you have a DE amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have a DE
amendment. I would move the DE amendment, and if you would just, I assume that just gets the bill in the shape you'd prefer?
Yes.
Members, all those in favor of the DE amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Feist, present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to thank the Minnesota Manufacturing and Modular Home Association and Haven Park Communities for working collaboratively with us to arrive at an agreement that is reflected in the DE that we just approved. This bill solves two festering problems. First, it clarifies the intent of the law that utility charges to residents are mere pass-throughs, and owners collect no more from residents than they are billed by utilities. The way the current law is written and has been interpreted by courts, owners can and some do charge residents more than they owe to the public utility, the Cooperative Electric Association, or the City Water Company. Second, this bill solves another ongoing issue by clarifying that park owners are permitted to install water meters to ensure that residents each pay for the water that they use and conservation is encouraged. And to ensure fairness, if water is already included in rent, if a park owner wants to install metering, the resident's rent will be frozen for 15 months to ensure that the resident is not paying twice for water usage. So glad that everyone could come together around this common sense update to the law to ensure that utility charges are uniformly passed on to residents of manufactured housing communities in an appropriate way. And with that, I'll turn it over to the person who orchestrated all of these important conversations and made this possible, Ron Elwood.
Ron Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I just want to thank Representative Feist and the Manufactured Home Park Owners Association, Modular Home Park Association folks, for working with us so collaboratively on this bill. As Representative Feist said, these are some issues that have been impacting our clients and owners for many years. And it's really just a pleasure to come before you today with a collaborative agreement to solve these two problems. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Up next, we have Mark Bruner. Welcome back. Long time no see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this bill, and to Legal Aid for working with us. Just a brief background, one of the reasons and the primary things the bill does is change the definition of a substantial modification of a lease agreement. And for several years, I think since 2002, the Minnesota Supreme Court determined that if a manufactured home community owner were to install water submetering devices when the water was previously included in lot rent, that was a substantial modification of the agreement. You could not submeter the water. And as a result of those class actions, I mean, they were multi-million dollar awards. So everything really came to a halt in terms of the ability to submeter water, and so everybody's was paying for their neighbor's excessive use of water in their rent, and so we're appreciative of working with Legal Aid on coming up with this new definition. And one of the things that we hope to work perhaps going into commerce on is just to clean up a provision that right now we believe removes private wells in manufactured home communities from any sort of regulatory scheme in terms of pricing water. You know, there are most communities in the metro area in the nearly 1,000 communities in Minnesota, you know, maybe 70 or 80 are located in the metro area. All of them certainly would be connected to a municipal water system. The balance, 800 and some in greater Minnesota, it's a mixed bag. So we just want to make sure that, for those that have private wells, that they're still part of a regulatory scheme in terms of what they charge for water consumption. But otherwise, we're certainly appreciative of all that this could accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any, is there anyone else here that would like to testify on the bill? And if not, are there questions from members? I'll go to Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question. I know that electric companies and utility companies and so forth, part of their fee is for the infrastructure here. And I'm guessing that in a lot of these cases, the infrastructure, I think the official term is the utility, is actually owned by the park owner and so forth. And we're not allowed to charge for that in regards to the usage fee. How do they, and I may know this answer, but I want to make clarified, how do they recoup their costs for upgrading their utility?
Representative Feist or Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, that is my understanding would be part of the rent, like everything else. I mean, all the other expenses that the park owner incurs to provide the services would be part of that. This is a, there's a separate section of law that this bill, starting on page 2.5 is really the guts of the bill in terms of the utility pass-throughs, and that's 327C04. And so that's what this is really about, is when they get the utility service from the public utility, from the cooperative, electric association, or the municipality, simply passing it through. And that's the scope of this bill. It's pretty narrow. I hope that answers your question.
Follow-up, Representative Petersburg?
Just for a second. That's kind of what I expected, too, and I just want to make sure that was the case and that people understand that when there is an increase, that rather than paying through utility costs, it's going to be increased rent for that particular property in order to cover that cost. And so sometimes caught between a rock and a hard place, you got to collect it some way in order to cover those expenses. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood.
Can I just add one other thing, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, I think you've put your finger on another issue that I think we're going to need to tackle as we go down the road here, which is the fact that park owners, manufactured home park owners, as well as landlords, are sort of in this odd position of sort of being kind of de facto utility companies. And it's one of those things that have been kind of bubbling up over the years, and our hope is to work with the park owners and the landlords and the utility companies in the coming months and years to try to figure out how that system is going to be fair. So I just want to point out, you've really put your finger on a key issue that we need to work on, but not in this bill.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Chair Howard. Representative Feist, I understand the amount of work you did on this bill, which I appreciate. The issue I have with it that isn't dealt with, Representative Petersburg brought up, if you have a 100-unit manufactured home park, to put those all 100 units onto a water metering system, just not labor, not time, just the water meter, and because it's a mobile home or a manufactured home, it's got to be underneath and insulated, so you don't have access to read the meter, so you have to have a remote meter reading available as well. You're looking at around $350 to $400 per unit, so you're looking at $35,000 to $40,000 to do that part. Most of them do not have that much capital outlay laying around to do it. So that those costs need to be figured out somehow. In your bill, it says the lot rents can't be increased for 15 months. So that makes it difficult to recoup those costs. And so what's happening right now, because we don't have meters, you have Mrs. Olson, who's 75, that uses less than 500 gallons of water a month. But you got Mr. and Mrs. Jones, three mobile homes down with four kids. They're using 3,000 gallons of water a month, but they're paying the same rate. It's not fair. That's why they'd like to go with metered, but most of the infrastructure in a manufactured home park is not up to city standards. They're usually using PVC or some other type of lines for water. And so it's the city doesn't want to take control of it or touch it because of liability issues. And I'm speaking from experience. I was in a city that they did do this back in the 80s, and it was a nightmare. Meters were freezing regularly, bursting, water running all over. It made it a little bit more difficult because it was the mayor that owned the manufactured home park. So it, we got through that. We ended up getting rid of the meters, going back to the way it was because it worked better. Because the infrastructure in those manufactured home parks is not up to par with city standards. But there again, to get it up to par, to do something like this, unfortunately, this bill inhibits that from doing it because of section or subdivision 6 on line 3.23, where they can't raise the rent to cover the cost that the infrastructure needs to be able to do it. I hope you'll keep working on that. So, but I understand this in an agreement. I will be supporting it.
Representative Feist.
Yep. I have kind of a high-level thought process in response, and then for, like, the technical response, Mr. Elwood might have some thoughts. So I have my own business. I have a law firm. I've had it for 12 years. And I don't get to just pass all of my costs on to my clients. I have a flat fee. And so some of my clients are really easy, and I make a lot of money. And some of my clients, I don't make any money. And that is the risk you take when you operate a business. And you hopefully have your fees, in this case rents, at a level where you can be profitable. And then the other thought, or I guess that's basically it. Like business owners are not able to pass on every single cost that they incur to the people they serve. Like that is, like, you take risk, you get reward, and you hopefully run a profitable business and you structure your fees accordingly. So I don't see that as problematic with the structure of this bill. Mr. Elwood is much more steeped in the minutiae of this bill, and he can speak with more specificity to your thoughts, but I just wanted to share that perspective.
Did you have a comment, Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I do have a lot of thoughts, and I'm happy to share them with you. But since you say you're voting for the bill, I think I'll keep those thoughts to myself at the moment.
Spoken like a grizzled veteran. Do you have any final comments, Representative Feist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Mr. Elwood. He brought a lot of people together to come up with the solution. It sounds like we can address some private well issues as we head to the next committee, but this is agreement between all of the stakeholders, and I would encourage folks to vote yes.
Members, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 156, as amended, be re-referred to the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Feist. We have one more bill, Representative 814, with Representative Norris. Representative Norris, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Chair Howard. I would like to move House File 814.
So moved. And I understand you have an author's amendment. Can you briefly explain your amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Howard. So this author's amendment just does some cleanup work on the final section of the bill. It was intended to be a revolving loan fund. Some of the language originally got drafted envisioning a grant program rather than loans. So this amendment just gets that into the shape that we intended.
Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Representative Norris. Please present your bill as amended. And we are a little short on time. So to you and to testifiers, if you could keep your remarks brief so we do save at least a little bit of time for members to ask questions before we move forward. Representative Norris.
Will do. Thanks, Chair Howard. Chair Howard, members, this bill, House File 814, is about completing the manufactured housing toolbox. It's a bipartisan bill, and want to thank the co-authors on the committee, Chair Howard, Lee Johnson, Representative Hussein, and Representative Dotseth. The diverse authorship group of this bill, both ideologically and geographically, shows just how important the manufactured housing issue is across Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, in my district alone, which represents the cities of Blaine and Lexington, there are 6 manufactured housing communities with a total of over 1,900 homes, the most of any legislative district in the state. Since 2017, the legislature has taken a bipartisan approach to tackling this issue. This bill attempts to build on that work and kind of round out that manufactured housing toolbox for our state. At a high level, there are 3 goals for this legislation. The first is providing manufactured housing communities with reliable and sustainable resources to maintain their infrastructure, allowing them to preserve affordable home ownership across the state. The second is to create lending products that allow manufactured housing residents to access affordable loans that will sustain new manufactured housing as an affordable home ownership option well into the future. And the third is to create a manufactured housing acquisition fund. This revolving loan fund would allow Minnesota residents to compete in the marketplace, especially against out-of-state buyers. And this is really designed, you know, earlier when we were hearing the other bill, I think everybody was in agreement that if we can get residents to buy the parks and take ownership of them, it's a great thing. The mechanism for that is something that is worth debating, but this is a tool that can help facilitate that process of allowing the residents to actually take an ownership interest in the parks. We're also not starting from scratch. Section 2 of this bill, the one focused on loan products, was in the Senate Housing Omnibus Bill last year. Section 4, the acquisition fund, was in both the House and Senate versions of the omnibus in 2022, and it builds on work that aims to advance, preserve, and create affordable home ownership. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my excellent testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Up first, we have Tori Clark, Executive Director with North Country, or NCF, excuse me. Yeah. Ms. Clark, welcome.
Was that me? Okay. Hello, everyone. Thank you, Chair and Representative Norris, for the invitation to testify. My name is Victoria Clark West, Executive Director of North Country Cooperative Foundation, or NCF. I am pleased to be joined by one of our cooperative's board presidents, Ms. Bev Adrian, who you'll be hearing from in just a few moments. Our organization is a nonprofit 501c3 with the mission of transforming lives and communities through cooperative enterprise. That mission is often carried out through educating and providing what we call technical assistance to those living in manufactured home communities as they organize and run their own resident-owned cooperatives. NCF has helped establish 10 cooperatives across the state, our most recent of which, and who Ms. Bev Adrian represents as the board chair, is in Chair Howard's district. And due to the help of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, we actually have one more rural-based community that is actively in the conversion process, so that's always exciting. 75% of the households that are served through this work in our client manufactured home communities make 60% of area median income, AMI, or below. And I always like to note that a full third of the households that we serve are considered extremely low income, making 30% of AMI or below. 42% of the households served are also Black, Indigenous, and people of color. We would like to thank the authors and co-authors of this important legislation who sit on this committee. Representative Norris, Chair Howard, Lee Johnson, Representative Hussein, and Representative Dotseth. Since the establishment of the Manufactured Housing Working Group in 2017, NCF has a long track record of working across the aisle with bipartisan and geographically diverse legislators to solve the affordable homeownership crisis. This bill attempts to build on the previous work of this group and other legislators to complete the manufactured housing toolbox, or to get closer to completing the toolbox of manufactured housing preservation in the state. I will now walk you through briefly the bill section by section and explain how this bill helps solve the affordable homeownership crisis in our state. So the first section of the bill is a policy-only addition. It just updates the covenants of the Manufactured Home Community Redevelopment Program, which you'll hear me refer to as MHCR. Every program comes with its own acronym. I apologize. It's a no-cost provision that allows Minnesota Housing to award loans in addition to grants with the MHCR program. This would bring the program in line with other existing programs at the agency and allow greater flexibility for the agency in utilizing these funds. In Section 3 of the bill, I'll explain a little bit more in detail about the MHCR program. The second section of the bill is, includes $25 million for the creation of innovative and affordable manufactured home lending products. While the legislature made a change in Minnesota state law in 2021 that allows for manufactured homes in resident-owned cooperatives to be titled as real property, the vast majority of manufactured homes and co-ops are still titled as personal property. This prevents the homeowners from securing affordable long-term financing on their homes. Additionally, this makes most manufactured housing residents ineligible for traditional down payment assistance programs and other first-time home buyer financing. There is a large coalition of what are considered community development financial institutions, or CDFIs, across the state. These are nonprofit, mission-oriented lenders who are designed to serve traditionally underserved communities that are that have expressed a willingness and an eagerness to offer more competitive home loan terms, down payment assistance, and rehab assistance programs, which is the primary use of this $25 million. The third section of the bill increases the amount available for the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure program, the MHCR program, to $15 million annually. I think the most compelling case for increasing the appropriation into this fund is just our experience with the latest round of the RFP for this program. So in 2021, the legislature allocated additional one-time funding to the MHCR program, resulting in the largest grant award cycle in the program's history. So in 2022, funding for over $9.5 million in infrastructure improvements in the community statewide in both cooperatives and privately owned communities, $5.9 million of these funds were secured by the cooperatives that we represent. There was $25.6 million in requests for the RFP in 2022, which just shows you the deep and abiding and urgent need to continue to make appropriations. And I would underscore Representative Norris's word of reliable and sustainable mechanism. So having an ongoing reliable source of funding into this program is really critical for practitioners like us that support these cooperatives to know that there's an ongoing source of support to complete these really critical infrastructure projects. And the last part of the bill is $10 million to establish a manufactured home cooperative acquisition fund. This addresses one of the kind of a market-based way of addressing the problem and providing the kind of quick capital resource that an organization like ours can work with residents to tap into to access the types of funding that they need to complete an acquisition. This section authorizes a one-time state expenditure to establish this revolving loan fund at Minnesota Housing that residents would be able to access in order to purchase their community and become a cooperative. And I'm going to go off script and just describe why this would be so impactful. Acquisitions are eligible through the MHCR program currently. The problem, it's great that they're eligible. We've only been able to use the grant program to do an acquisition one time, and it's because the stars aligned and we got the purchase agreement under contract the same day that the MHCR awards were due, or the grant applications were due. That never happens in commercial real estate, just to underscore that point. So having a ready source that can be applied to on a rolling basis that we can have residents tap into, and then once we work them through the process to secure the permanent financing or the acquisition financing to secure the purchase, that money can be revolved. But it's that access to timely capital that's really critical for these deals. So just to give you a sense of what the impact of that portion of the bill would have. So thank you for your time, and I will hand it over to Bev Adrian to discuss how this legislation would help manufactured home communities like hers.
Up next, we have Bev Adrian, board president from Woodlawn Terrace Cooperative from Richfield, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Adrian.
Thank you. I'm Bev Adrian. I am the president of Woodlawn Terrace Cooperative, located in the heart of Richfield, Minnesota. And thank you, Chair. It's your district. 16 years ago, I was preparing myself for retirement. I was downsizing. It was a beautiful, double-wide, brand-new home in a park in Bloomington called Shady Lane. I bought the home from the park owner, and 2 weeks later I was notified that the park was closing. The park owner knew that he was closing that park when he sold that home to me. It lit a fire in me, and I became a resident activist, helped organize the community. We formed a resident association. We attempted to purchase that park. We were unsuccessful, unfortunately. I had to move my home. The park owner was forced to pay for the movement of that home. It was over $10,000. These homes are not mobile, and they're not cheap to move. But the problem was, it was a double wide, and there was no easy place to move that home to in the vicinity. Moving right along, 16 years, I found a little home in Richfield, Woodlawn Terrace, and I approached the park owner, and I said, I know people. I've met some people that help the residents organize so that they can become owners of the property. I said, would you be willing to talk to the people that I know? And those people are NCF, Tori. And the park owner said, sure, I'll talk to them. So I called Tori and NCF, and the park owner worked through the purchase agreement. And fortunately, we were financed by Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And we are the park, we are the 10th co-op in the state. And we closed on December 30th at 12 o'clock noon. Our purchase agreement expired at midnight. It was amazing. Since then, we have been beneficiaries of a grant from the MHCR fund. We have $1 million grant to work on our infrastructure. We bought a property that had been neglected for many, many, many years. One of the things people don't realize in cities, the utilities in our parks are private utilities. Our well is private. Our water system, our electricity is private. Xcel Energy didn't even know that we were there. So everything, all of the utilities on property are private and our responsibility to maintain. We were able to finance or fund, we were fortunate to be granted $1 million infrastructure fund from the state for the improvement of our water system, our sewer lines, our roads. We are going to be installing city water in the spring. As a result of that, the city of Richfield jumped on board and granted us also $350,000 in a partnership with the state grant. So this fund is very important. Infrastructure is critical in all of the parks in the state. It's one of the last things that park owners want to pay for because it's very expensive. And we inherited, you know, a mess. But we're moving forward. We're optimistic. We're troopers. And we're going to make this work. And your cooperation will be very much appreciated if you could add a little bit of money to that pot. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Adrian. Members, we are coming up on our time. We do have the ability to go a little longer. And so up next, we have Mark Bruner. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. I'd like to thank Representative Norris for bringing the bill. And you know, certainly members of our association and other privately owned communities have been very active in participating in the infrastructure grant program in updating their infrastructure in their communities. And I do recognize some of the language in the bill from last session, particularly in the Senate. And would encourage the committee to, under the home loan sort of grant program on 2-7 and 2-8, to also include privately owned manufactured home communities. So when there are loans that are that flow to homeowners, that if you your home is in a privately owned manufactured home community, that you too could qualify for down payment assistance or whatever. And Fannie and Freddie, the two GSEs, are working on programs right now for home-only loan assistance in manufactured home communities. So if that launches, in the next year or two, it would be terrific if the privately owned communities were also included in the state program, so that everything would come together for all residents of manufactured home communities. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Members, there isn't A1 that Representative Johnson had submitted. Did you want to speak or to the A1?
Chair Howard, because of the prior amendment to the bill, it makes my amendment irrelevant, but I'd still like to speak on it a little bit. Representative Norris, you do have some things that should be required in this bill, but I'm glad you have. That's in 2.15 to 2.17, requiring the commissioner to develop the forms, applications, and reporting requirements for use of the eligible organization. I would also suggest you look at the recommendations in the OLA report on grants, because those are the same things that we should be looking at for loans. There is a number of them, 10 different areas with about 30 different issues that in our grants to nonprofits have issues, and I want to make sure we don't have them in the loan issue as well. So please take a look at them and look, see if we can incorporate some of those things that the commissioner should go through that and make sure that those are in the policies as well, because not only who gets the money, but we have to make sure that it's being used properly, proper oversight of the loans, and at the very end when they're done, that we have proper close out of them, that the funds are used properly. And with that, I'll withdraw the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there questions that members have? If not, I'll go to Representative Norris for any closing comments.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I'll just reiterate that manufactured housing is our best source of naturally occurring affordable housing in this state. This bill is designed to give us more tools in our toolbox to help make sure we're preserving and expanding that housing, and I look forward to working in a bipartisan fashion with the committee to hopefully include this in our omnibus.
Thank you for bringing this bill. And with that, I'll renew my motion that House Bill 814, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. Members, that concludes our hearing. And this meeting is adjourned.